Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. It's spring. Last week, I made a brief visit to the rural community where I grew up, and the planting has begun on the farms, just as it always does this time of year. But one thing was different. For the very first time at my mother's home, I was able to log on to a broadband internet connection. It reminded me of a set of conversations I was exposed to last fall about what the quote-unquote AI revolution means for rural communities. Last October, Dr. Jasmine McNeely, as a senior fellow in tech policy with the Mozilla Foundation, an associate professor at the University of Florida, and a faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, wrote in Tech Policy Press about the need for a policy agenda for rural AI. "Rural communities matter," she wrote, "and that means they should matter when it comes to the development of policies on artificial intelligence." The piece was a preview of sorts to a two-day workshop McNeely organized at the University of Florida in Gainesville that touched on topics ranging from connectivity to bias and discrimination in algorithmic systems to the connection between AI and natural resources. Last week, I checked in with some of the attendees about the ideas we discussed at the workshop.
Jasmine McNeely, I'm on faculty at the University of Florida.
Michaela Henley, I'm the program director, curriculum writer at Black Tech Futures. I'm also the senior research fellow representing Black Tech Futures at the Siegel Family Endowment for their 2024-2025 cohort.
Dr. Dominique Harrison, and I'm founding principal of Equity Innovation Ventures, which is a consultancy helping organizations think about responsible innovation.
Dr. Theodora Dreyer, I'm the director of Water Justice and Technology Studio and founder of the Critical Carbon Computing Collective. I also teach on technology and environmental justice at New York University.
I thank you all for joining me. We were convened at a very interesting workshop symposium at the University of Florida at Gainesville just a few months ago. It seems like a long time ago. Lots happened in the world, but it was only just a few months ago. And the subject was rural artificial intelligence. So as a person who grew up in a rural place, I was very pleased to get invited to this and to have the opportunity to come and learn from each of you about when we think about artificial intelligence, what's different in a rural context and what are the types of unique questions that we can ask when thinking about how to develop policies around artificial intelligence when thinking through the lens of the interests of people in rural communities. Jasmine, you pulled that together. It was your brainchild. I'd love to hear from you just first. Why did you get interested in this subject and what led you to kind of convene this group of people on your campus?
So when thinking about the artificial intelligence conversations that are being had, especially with respect to what policy needs to do regarding artificial intelligence, questions about fairness and bias and equity, many of those conversations leave out geography as a perhaps exacerbating or amplifying factor in outcomes in general, but with respect to the use of artificial intelligence technologies, that big tent of artificial intelligence technologies. But we know that artificial intelligence technologies are being used in these areas and that rural areas are home to almost, 20% of people who live in the United States. And those people don't look all the same. They don't have the same histories, but they do have many of the same, like what our colleagues in public health would call social determinants, with regard to health outcomes, education outcomes, economic outcomes and economic mobility. And all these things affect life, many different aspects of life and outcomes of life, but they're left out of this huge conversation about this technology or set of technologies that are now ubiquitous and having significant impacts on how people live, right? So how can you make policy that's supposed to be good when you leave out a significant segment of the population or ignore the people impacted by the technology. And because I live in Gainesville, which is the county seat of Alachua County in Florida, and when people think about Florida, they think of Disneyland or they think of Miami Beach, and they think, oh, Florida's built up. It really is not. There are 67 counties. Not all of them contain a Tampa or a Jacksonville. And in fact, if you go, I'd say 5 minutes outside of Gainesville, it gets really rural really quickly. And so what are the implications for even a university that has turned its eyes to AI everything for all of the spaces surrounding that city, that university space? So that's what I want. That's how I wanted to approach it. Can we make good policy while ignoring this huge segment of the population?
Dr. Harrison, I'd love to bring you in just on a framing thought as well. I know you were involved in the process that led to the drafting of the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, so very much concerned with these questions about algorithmic fairness and how to do artificial intelligence in a way that respects rights and questions of equity. What drew you to this event?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So at the time, I was leading the technology policy program at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. And while I was there in really thinking about some of the topics that the center would cover, AI privacy, fairness came up as topics that were of importance. And what I found was, in speaking to a number of stakeholders across nonprofit, private sectors, was that there was, you know, kind of insidious things going on as it related to the data that was used to build programs, products, and services that were not meeting the needs of all communities. And in particular, I gathered a group of folks to think about how could we use anti-discrimination laws that we currently have on the books to address these issues, given that there are not a lot of policies in relations to AI technology, and nor do we have a privacy, federal privacy bill. And a lot of things were learned in terms of how AI is used in financial services, in terms of the kind of technologies that decide who gets a loan, who's approved for certain products and services, AI in education, and how those systems are used to place students across different cities, just because it makes it easier for some states. AI is used in health, of course, for better practices and kind of products to address health needs, but sometimes the data of communities of color is not incorporated. So the point was that, yes, it's exciting to have this new kind of technology that's out there and it's being rolled out in a number of different areas, but how can we make sure that communities, particularly communities of color, who are often, you know, kind of receive the short end of the stick, to ensure that their needs, desires, and really there is inclusion and equity through the use of these technologies. And so that's what grew me to the topic. And folks from the White House Office of Science and Technology and Policy reached out to us to host that conversations with other leaders. And really those insights is what led to us, me, our organization, and various other organizations led to the insights and inputs that you see in that Bill of Rights.
I want to talk about some of the various points of discussion that have continued to play out over the last few months we've seen in different ways. But I thought one of the through lines that has become a kind of important one in just the last couple of weeks is this argument has unfolded about whether to renew funding for the Affordable Connectivity Program in this country. It's just the question about broadband and connectivity and whether rural places even have the very first thing that one might need to participate in the quote unquote AI revolution, which is just internet access. Michaela, I thought I might come to you on that one a little bit and some of the ways you're thinking about that.
I will say at Black Tech Futures and in my research, that's still our number one goal, is specifically addressing the digital divide. So we believe, especially with our current partners and stakeholders, for example, I very specifically am working on a project that's going to be piloted by HBCUs, and majority of them, out of the 101 of them, are located in throughout the rural South, right? We can't have conversations around generative AI, large language models, and things of that nature if people aren't even online. And what we're finding in our research is that even at the institutional level, even if they have access to broadband, there's then a next infrastructure issue with, you know, some of the infrastructure is old or it's outdated or it's slow even, right? We're really persistent on, we can't move on to these other conversations until that is addressed. And I would say, as my background outside of BTF is an education policy person, and I've served in the classroom specifically in rural America. And I believe at this point, having access to the internet is so important for having those foundational digital literacy skills. It's going to be as fundamental, if not already, as reading and writing, whether that's in, obviously, in a K-12 context, and that trickles into institutions who are preparing our talent for then the workforce, right? So folks who aren't getting online until they're in secondary school, if that, or even in college, if they have access, they are starting off extremely far behind. And that has a trickle-down effect on all of those bits that Dr. Harrison alluded to with misrepresentation or disproportionate representation of the talent in tech. And then consequently, like, who's forming the policy around the tech and things of that nature. Digital divide all the way still needs to be a part of this conversation.
Another thing that was discussed a good deal at the symposium that I hadn't thought about before I got there, but obviously makes perfect sense, which is this general kind of lack of data or dearth of good data from rural places. And one of the pre-reads Jasmine shared with us from a behavioral data scientist, Ghana Pogrebna, talking about the idea that the AI revolution is overlooked in these rural communities. And in part, that it's a just fact of the matter that the kinds of plumes of information that come off of our urban areas perhaps are more scarce in a rural context.
The issue is there is data from certain kinds of data, I should say certain kinds of data in rural spaces, agricultural data, environmental data, for example. What's lacking is a lot of data on humans, the human aspects, right? If we're talking about, just talked about connectivity, one of the ways that there's a lot of data from urban spaces is from our phones. But if you don't have the same amount of towers and sensing infrastructure in rural spaces, you're not going to be collecting. And as a privacy person, I would say, as a general matter, good, don't be collecting all of this information. At the same time, some of that data is really useful. When you think about the states and their need to have data about what's going on in the rural spaces of their state, where those states need to deploy, say, ACP funds, so they can apply for BDAC funds from the Biden administration, they need data. They need to be able to say, these zip codes don't have this. Therefore, we need this amount of money. They're missing that. On the other hand, the state, not the states, but a lot of third parties, corporate organizations have a lot of data about what's happening in rural spaces because they are the parties that are being used by farmers, ranchers, aquaculturalists to collect data for precision farming or just upgrading their farming systems. And then they can claim ownership of that data and use it for whatever they want to use it for. And so you have a data stratification, if you want to, where states are finding that they have a dearth of data, but these corporate structures have a whole lot of data to make a lot of money off of.
It's funny how in the time since we met, so much of my research has led me, even if it's just personal interest, to this conversation around data and data ownership. And I think that's probably going to become a huge conversation, especially in rural America, as we're talking about language and the data needed to program these language models. I think a lot of the corporations, like Jasmine mentioned, are their approach is like more is more is more. But that approach, you end up losing a bit of the nuance and you definitely lose the ownership. And I think the other thing to keep in mind along that note, because there's a need for it, otherwise things get lost, right? If language carries culture with it, identity, without that, I also like, while broadband and the digital divide is foundational, people love to generalize rural America and in particular the South, because that's my experience in rural America in the South. For folks who are online, or do have or have devices, right? A lot of them are those Internet of Things devices in their homes that are collecting data all the time. They actually might not have that kind of literacy piece about what is the data that's being collected on them. And so I think there should be a real shift in that conversation around, okay, you have these devices in your home, they're collecting data on you. You might not even realize that. You might even realize who's collecting it and then consequently how it's being used. And I do think there could be a really cool, nuanced conversation that shifts towards individuals being mindful of that and helping us push for more of that opt-in policy about data collection across the board, especially with devices in the home, where in rural America, it's easy. It might be easier, I don't know, to pick up on where the data is actually coming from just by, you know, the space, right? So those are the things that I'm thinking about that are coming up a lot in my research, data ownership, data sovereignty, and then also impact. That's probably going to transition really easily, especially in rural America. And when we talk about impact on the environment and space.
Let's bring those ideas in here, because Thea, that was one of the things that you brought to the table, I think, most significantly. There were a number of folks there with interests in things like agricultural and natural resources, talking about some of those things. That's your specialty. You've looked in particular at how we apportion access to water in parts of this country and think about other types of algorithmic decision making around resource management. When it comes to thinking about these questions, what do you see with regard to rural places and artificial intelligence?
One thing I really appreciated about this event that Dr. Jasmine McNeely convened was just the event itself helped demystify some of the kind of hegemonic beliefs about AI. And I think one of those is that AI, you know, resides in Silicon Valley or in Lincoln Labs at MIT, when in fact, the rural, what we're talking about is not the periphery, it's the center of AI development and implementation. And there's this almost paradoxical thing happening because, as Dr. McNeely just described, there's a dearth of data about humans and rural life experiences, but then there's a richness or an overabundance of data about the environment and about water. And I think sometimes in the sexy mystique about AI, it sounds like AI is like the sentient creature being or something like this from a H.G. Wells novel. But AI is it's a data project, and it's a patchwork data project of different predictive analytic models and information systems. It looks more like Frankenstein's monster being patchworked together. And the reason AI is in rural places is because the environmental sciences, the hydrological sciences, even climate science are data-rich environments, and they're historically data-rich. And water is an incredibly data-rich environment. And the way in which water has been datafied and commodified and financialized is a very old story related to colonial resource control. And so AI is moving into these spaces. And I see you know, if we're going to start talking about justice at this nexus of water data and environmental data, the kind of prerogative is for us to confront the genealogies of inequitable resource control that have already been at work in these environments before it was named AI. And so that a lot of my research looks at these stratifications of resource laws that although we may be seeing machine learning mediations today that are new and novel, they're built on very old systems. I think two of the things that are prominent in my work right now, I'm here in Colorado. I grew up in Colorado, Littleton, Colorado. A lot of us grew up in rural environments. I consider Littleton, Colorado to be the imperial core of a settler colonial resource control and also militarism. These waters are militarized, and there's a water law called the 1922 Colorado River Compact that is our Herbert Hoover era. He had dreams of hydraulic empire. That's where Hoover Dam comes from. But this water law was literally created by seven white men in Hoover who are representing the U.S. states of the Colorado River Basin region. There were no representations from the 29 tribal communities in the region. And they implemented what is called quantitative water law. So it's a calculus, and it's about calculating and dividing the water between U.S. states. And I could talk a lot about this water law, but it's kind of a manipulative tactic. In addition to being just blatantly settler colonial, it does silly things like over allocate the water by design. So even in its premised calculations, the Colorado River waters are over allocated. So this water law has caused the Colorado River mega drought crisis that we are currently experiencing. And so this water law is both the legal, but also quantitative analytical premise for AI development. So you can't even begin to talk about AI implementation with Colorado River waters without acknowledging it. It's explicitly and implicitly built into the logic systems. I could give another example, which is a similar kind of methodological intervention, which is to confront the water laws that are fueling and enabling AI development. In 1967, Israel passed what was called Military Order 158. And Military Order 158 was in collaboration with a water company called Mikorat. And Mikorat mandated that Palestinians were not allowed to develop their own water infrastructures, nor have any sovereignty rights over water. So this is in 1967. And today, Mikorat continues to work in collaboration with the Israeli state to control over 3,000 water pumping stations throughout Palestine. But significantly, Mikorat is leading AI innovation in water sustainability globally. So if you follow the relationships and the money infrastructures around this company, it's connected to places in the United States and in Latin America. So it's a multinational enterprise, but that is claiming to be leading climate sustainability projects, false climate solutions through AI innovation, but it's dependent on this old settler colonial water law, the 1967 military order, which is directly analogous to the 1922 Colorado River Compact. So you can see how that, if we're going to start talking about water justice and AI innovation, we need to confront the deeper histories of apartheid resource control and colonial water law.
Another one of the threads that I did pick up on during the symposia was the extent to which some of the issues we're talking about with regard to rural places in the United States really are more reminiscent of maybe some of the questions we might ask about other resource-constrained environments elsewhere in the world. So there were some folks there who have experience of doing policy work in South Asia or Africa, for instance. And there seem to be some real parallels with the types of equity concerns they have about how Silicon Valley AI companies are rolling out their products and services, hoovering up raw earths and variously accessing natural resources along the way.
A point that just came to me as Theo was talking was just when folks build technology, who is building it, for what purpose, and for whom? And I think when you begin to trace those lines, a lot of interesting questions, challenges, and perhaps opportunities come up that often don't lead to results of inclusivity and equality. That's just something that bubbled up in my mind as she was talking. I'm still thinking through the ideas, but I just wanted to share that because what made me think about, for example, a technology like the iPhone and how different apps are used across the world. There's, I think, a case right now dealing with antitrust around who can build the apps in the app store, who can make money from those apps. And again, I just think about the implications of the technology that is built in a particular part of the world, and then the ramification for communities across the world, given that owner or that creator who's built it for a particular community, class, et cetera. So yeah, I'm going to keep thinking through that, but that's what that came to mind.
It also, I think the way in which we talk about technology as this big umbrella and even AI at this point is a little bit in the like colonial style, in the sense that tech started with Silicon Valley and no one was advancing technological innovation before computer science became mainstream. When in fact, if a lot of this emerging tech is informed by data, everybody has a role to play in it. And then even thinking about Thea's research and her comments about the environment, which I know little about, but it's just been really fascinating for me how much more my ears are perking up about the impact of technology. I can't wait to see what comes out of Indigenous communities about the impact of technology, because a lot of the research I've been doing over the spring, I keep coming back to this book called Braiding Sweetgrass. I highly recommend it. I can't think of the author right now. The first name I think is like Robin, something. I read it a few years ago. She's not talking about tech necessarily, but she's talking about the relationship between humans and the environment and it being a reciprocal relationship. And I've been thinking about, okay, if AI is in theory should be the best of us, it's outsmarting us. I wonder if we can have certain communities who we should start to shift the language, who have the knowledge, probably the knowledge that we should be using to program a lot of this technology. And so they should be leading certain conversations around it. So thinking about Dr. Harrison's initial thoughts, like who's creating what, right? That really starts to, then you start to unpack that, like that more is more. And maybe it makes the case for this is the type of model we should use when we're talking about this issue. This is the type of model we should use when we're in this community. This is, and not just one blanket technology that can address everything, because we know it won't. And again, I do think that's a little bit of that colonial mindset, that there aren't maybe perhaps smaller communities who have a huge role to play in addressing some of these larger social issues, especially when it comes to things like the environment, because we haven't been doing a great job. Jasmine laughed about it being hot in Florida. It's been hot in DC. I'm dreading next week. Climate change is real. And so we need everyone trying to get this technology to help us to address it, because we haven't been doing a good job. And we definitely have not been doing it with respect and reciprocity. We've been abusing the environment. And I only worry that'll get worse.
So I think it's important to have a global perspective on AI, if only to think about AI as destabilizing with respect to both the hardware and software. As we're not popularly paying attention to Congo right now, but Congo is a place where if people weren't extracting things from Congo, we wouldn't be able to use the mobile phone devices, which provide so much data and are home to many of these AI-ish apps and systems that we use or that are being deployed, right? But also Africa, Latin America are spaces where people are, well, both data is being extracted. It is no secret why many of the undersea cables are off the coast of Africa and Latin America. Data being extracted in a colonial fashion, but also that these are spaces where they can hire really cheap labor to train algorithms to be part of the labeling and categorization and content moderation that causes PTSD, right? So this is a huge system of systems of systems, whereby globally, the same people that we talk about rurally in the United States, but urban in urban spaces too, not neglecting that, are having similar impacts, right? Similar things are happening, slightly different, but we cannot ignore the larger impacts of these systems for people across the globe, whether they're in rural spaces or from rural spaces, trying to be employed in urban spaces, and these are the jobs that are available. But also the fact that many of those ignored countries, I'm going to say Kenya, for example, are at the vanguard of stopping or prohibiting certain companies from behaving in an extractive manner. Kenya has been like, absolutely not, WorldCoin or whatever, get out of here, get out. We won't take this anymore. So some of these countries that we ignore are saying, absolutely not, where we in the West or Global North or whatever are saying, okay, we'll allow it. And then impacting people in ways that I don't think we've fully even discovered how it's going to really impact people in the long term.
One of the things that also came through at the event was this sort of feeling that we can't get AI policy right until we get a broader sort of sense of what we're trying to do with regard to economic development, social safety net, the types of policies we want to create for the whole country, what type of economy we want to build. But that's particularly true when it comes to rural areas. So it's got a bit aimless with regard to rural policy in this country. Is that something that you'd agree with, Jasmine? Is that a sort of sense that you got from some of the participants?
I did get that sense from many participants, and not just from the participants, but from like developments across policy, just in general in the United States, but globally. I would say that there, as a precursor to AI policy, there are so many policies that we need to reevaluate, redo, implement, or enforce on a regular basis in an equitable manner that could mitigate many of the impacts or harms related to artificial intelligence, but almost any technology that we are allowing to become ubiquitous. Anti-discrimination laws related to fraud and deception, intellectual property, absolutely. Laws that we have on the books regarding so many different things that we don't enforce in ways that are equitable all the time. Or there are huge gaps where we need, and we have needed, law or policy for a long time. I'm going to say privacy or data security in the United States. A very long time. We are behind many of the places in the rest of the world with regards to that. And so I think there are some spaces that we can make inroads even before the AI policy that could have a huge impact then on AI policy, but on life in general with regard to technology.
I think the Rural AI event allowed us to reformulate our policy containers around AI. And I think one of the interventions we've already discussed is that AI works through abstraction, but also extraction. And a lot of times when we're not like talking about the rural, folks are getting preoccupied with the abstraction and the data. And that's how they get into these kind of self-referential and infinite loops of perfecting the data, or even quantifying how much water ChatGPT uses without talking about mining conditions, without talking about labor, without talking about the digital divide, which is all the extractive context. I also think engagement with rural AI challenges policymakers to move beyond the nation state as a policy container. And when we're talking about places like Kenya and Congo, these are neo-colonial colonial contexts where CSS development, AI might, like for every extractive mega tech project that is blatantly about resources like mining cobalt, which Michaela brought up, there's like a data tech system being built for mining cobalt. So there's the actual mining of the cobalt, and then they're saying, oh, we can create computer vision to help us predict where to mine cobalt. So it's like this infinite regression of insanity. I think the rural AI context this allows us to challenge the policy containers that in many cases may be perpetuating the mythology and violence of AI development in the first place.
There's so much here. There are a lot of challenges that we are dealing with historically, presently, and that are to come. And it is really important, as Jasmine mentioned, to be creating these kind of policies that can address the issues we're dealing with now and in the future. I mean, a lot of the conversation around AI today is around generative AI and large language models. One of the things I had advocated for while at the Joint Center were for us to think about the applications of AI right now and the kind of harms that they're having for our communities. And because we don't have policy to address some of these issues and we allow industry to self-govern themselves, they go on making products and services using the data of individuals, making a profit, and having results that lead to less home ownership for communities of color, that lead to unequal education for children, unequal health outcomes for communities. We can already imagine that many of these challenges may be exacerbated for rural communities. And as we continue to develop questions and seek answers and really try to address or mitigate these issues, it would behoove us to try to move fast in the policymaking process, because at the rate at which we're going, and unfortunately the ways in which government operates, technology will continue to develop and evolve in ways that might make it a little harder for us to understand the algorithms that are being developed and the black box data that is used to fuel those systems. And so I'm a little bit of a pessimist, and I'm a little bit worried because, as I mentioned, these issues are having a mark on people today.
I'll end with a short snippet. I'm still very much in close contact with my former principal when I was a K-12 teacher. So I taught in Mississippi. My principal still lives and teaches in Mississippi. She's from Mississippi. I'm not originally from there. Mississippi holds a dear place in my heart. And over COVID, I remember we were just touching base. I was like, what's it been like for y'all? Because school was closed. And I think it was over 75%. I think I'm being conservative of the student population wasn't online. And so the staff were literally dropping off packets to the kids' homes. When you think about that context, I pull myself out of an AI conversation because I'm like, how do those kids who, again, eventually will be a part of the workforce, how do they make sense of all of the stuff that we're talking about if they end up starting so far behind? that's always what I come back to. That's why, even though the digital divide conversation at this point isn't as sexy as like generative AI and AI anymore, it still needs to get brought up in all of these conversations because, again, it's foundational.
Jasmine, I'm going to give you the last word, but with a question, which is, what's next for this? Is there a research agenda that emerges from this? Will you continue to pursue it? And will you gather this group together again in the future?
So yes to all of those. This is a continuing thing because this is a continuing problem. I don't, like, until we get it fixed, we'll have something to continue to talk about, discuss. I do want to get people together again, whether it's this year in the fall or in the springtime. We'll see what happens. But definitely want to continue having people talk, work on projects, and move the discussion forward, whether that's with policymakers or with everybody else. So that's what I think is important.
So I want to thank each of you for joining me today. And I'll just say, Dr. Jasmine McNeely, a lightning rod for interest and curiosity around rural AIs. We thank you for putting this together. And I assume folks can easily figure out how to find you if they hear this podcast, and perhaps it inspires them to want to get involved with the agenda that you're pulling together. Dr. Harrison, Dr. Dreyer, Dr. McNeely, Michaela, thank you so much, all of you, for joining me today.
I'm feeling like Howard Wolowitz on Big Bang, not having the doctor.
You and me both, Michaela.
Oh, the both of us? All right. All right, then. They're the two engineers.
Thank you all.
Just teasing. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guests, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.